We have to recall from last night that we are looking for solutions to systems in this form here on some open subsets of RK. U, the unknown, the state vector, takes values in Rn. G also takes values in Rn. We have a system of n equations in n unknowns, if you wish. And sometimes, often, this system will be supplemented by a companion conservation law, which will be an honest conservation law only within the context of classical solutions, of smooth functions, whereas in the context of weak solutions, this will no longer be zero, but still it will be required to have a constant sign. This will be induced physical considerations, stability, or other considerations here. Today, however, I want to visualize RK as space-time. I want to separate space from time, so k will be m plus 1, m will be the dimension of space, the typical point capital X now will be written as space and time, and I want to take the last component of this g and for convenience identify to the state vector itself u, and for physical reason, for physical considerations, I want to take the last component of capital Q and denote it by eta of U and call it entropy, and then the remainder of Q will constitute the heat flux. This will be now the entropy flux. This will now be, of course, a vector in Rm. Okay, so this comes from last time. So now I may rewrite my system in this form. In components form, you see the time derivative of u is balanced by the spatial divergence of the vector field capital G. X takes values in Rm. This denotes the partial derivative with respect to the alpha component of X. And I will be interested in systems that are hyperbolic. This means that for any value of our state vector u, and any direction new in space, this n by n matrix has real eigenvalues and then linearly independent eigenvectors. If you associate that with my discussion yesterday, you will see that it essentially means that such systems admit a very rich family of shocks, of shock fronts, in fact, n independent families of shock fronts, so that's exactly what characterizes hyperbolicity, the ability of these systems to support a rich family of waves. And the condition of having a companion conservation law that is satisfied as an inequality in the class of weak solutions is expressed by this admissibility condition. Where, as I said before, eta is the entropy and Q is the entropy flux of associated with that entropy. And the condition that tells us that we are dealing here with a companion conservation law, namely that this identically vanishes for every smooth solution of our system, takes this form here. The gradient of Q is related to the gradient of eta through this condition. And again, let me point out that if you count the number of equations here, you find out that this system is highly overdetermined, but we are interested in systems with special structure for which we have indeed non-trivial entropy-entropy flux pairs, and we shall see particular examples as we go along. Now, we're interested in, let's say, the Cauchy problem for hyperbolic systems of that type. And I told you last time that dramatic progress has been achieved over the last few years. What is that progress? Well, first of all, that progress concerns the case where m equals 1, systems in just one spatial variable. Now, for such systems, all we knew up until, let's say, 6 or 7 years ago was the famous result of Glim from the 1960s that said that if the initial data are functions with small total variation, then there is indeed some solution to the initial value problem, which is a function of class BV. We knew nothing about the uniqueness of such a solution, we knew nothing about the stability properties of that solution, and even the existence itself was obtained through a very precise, a very delicate construction. Okay? Now, over the past 6 or 7 years, a revolution has occurred, and that was spearheaded by Bressan and his students, but other people now who have joined somehow in the effort. So now, for instance, we know that that solution constructed by Gleim is unique, that it is stable in L1. It can be constructed by other methods, for instance, by the vanishing viscosity method, putting on the right-hand side the small viscosity and letting the viscosity go to zero. So for people who have been thinking about this problem for a long time, this indeed has been a major development, some kind of revolution. On the other hand, if you look at this from some distance, you see that still what we know is quite limited. Even in one spatial dimension, all the results require that the initial data have small total variation. And in fact, we know from counterexamples and so on, that when the total variation of the initial data is large, then strange things happen, things that we don't understand at all. So it will take a lot of effort, first of all, to extend the theory, even in the case m equals 1, when the initial data are large. Right? So this is problem number 1. However, the major problem arises when m is bigger than 1. This is truly terra incognita. We know nothing about it, and as I go along, I will explain what are the obstructions. Not only we know nothing about it, but what we know is of negative nature in a certain sense. This doesn't work, this cannot work, the other thing cannot work. So I will discuss this as we go along. So first of all, let me tell you, however, certain things that we do know about systems that are large. In fact, certain things are known for a long time, and Walter yesterday gave us some information on this. So for instance, we know that if initial data is sufficiently smooth, then, at least for a short time, we do have a classical solution that is unique, stable, and everything else. More specifically, if the gradient of the initial data belongs to the Sobolev space HL, where L is bigger than half the dimension of our space, then there exists a unique classical solution. It belongs to the same space as the initial data, but only exists on a maximal interval of existence, and this is maximal in the sense that if it's not infinity as you approach it, then the first derivatives have to blow up. Actually, for Euler equations, we have seen a more precise statement here about what happens when you get blow up. But in any case, this is a very old result. Essentially, the idea is due to Sauder from the 1930s, who used it in a more specific example. But the theorem at this level of generality can be found in papers by Kato, Maida, the Book of Taylor, and so on, from the Friedrichs also, yes, Friedrichs, 1940s, right. Okay, so this is more or less the story of this theorem. Here, let me point out, I'm sure you know that this situation in which T infinity is less than infinity and you get blow up is not the exception, but the rule, right? So typically, generically, this is what happens. So if you want to find global solutions, you have to look for weak solutions. It's hopeless to try to find globally defined a smooth solution. So let me talk about weak solutions. So for weak solutions, first of all, I have to decide what space this solution should be sought at. And as I will explain in a few minutes, this is presently unknown. So just in order to be able to talk about these functions, these solutions, I will just be considering solutions that are in L infinity. This does not mean that I expect that we will have existence in that space here. Right? There are examples, of course, of weak solutions in that space. For M equals 1, for instance, but even for several space dimensions. Also, let me remind you that when I'm talking about weak solutions, I have to talk about solutions that satisfy an additional admissibility condition, because unfortunately it turns out that in general, in the class of weak solutions, uniqueness is lost. Not only we don't have classical solutions, but if we are looking for weak solutions, then you don't have uniqueness. So you have to require to impose additional restrictions on your solutions, and some of these restrictions take the form of an inequality of this type, where eta is some entropy. And this condition comes from physics, expresses the second law of thermodynamics, typically in the physically motivated examples. Let me also point out that once you assume that your solution is in L infinity, in fact it is slightly better. You do get some continuity with respect to time, but of course very weak continuity. This is a result of that trace theorem that I discussed yesterday, essentially. It's a very simple, very special case of that trace theorem, that you can find the trace of U. No, it's not BV. It's, if you remember, if the divergence of that vector field is a measure, here is zero, then you can find the trace of the normal component. So, on, let's say, t equals constant on such surfaces, you can find the trace of u itself, essentially. So that's the meaning of that statement here. So you can talk, this is more or less like a dynamical system of certain sorts. You can say, for instance, if you have a solution on zero infinity, you take the restriction on another set, this is also a solution, and so on. You have this semi-group property, if you wish, for these solutions. But that's all you have if you make that assumption here. And of course, this is the statement that it is a weak solution, and this is the statement that the solution is admissible. Here, psi, of course, is an arbitrary non-negative test function. Okay, so this is, these are the weak solutions, and there is something that you can prove even for these weak solutions, or rather something you can prove about classical solutions embedded in the family of weak solutions, interpreted as weak solutions. There is an L2 stability result that says the following thing. Assume that the system is associated with the convex entropy. Whenever I say convex, I mean uniformly convex, strictly convex. Suppose that you do have a classical solution, and suppose that you have any other admissible weak solution. Then the L2 distance of these two solutions is controlled by the L2 distance of their initial data. Okay? So in particular, classical solutions are unique solutions to the Cauchy problem, not only within the class of other classical solutions, but even within the broader class of weak solutions that are admissible. And it's not difficult to see the proof of this result. Let me sketch here the proof, that is extremely simple. So this is your classical solution, satisfies the differential equation and also satisfies the companion balance law as an equality because it's classical. This is your weak solution, it satisfies the equation as an equation, satisfies the entropy condition as inequality. And then you define these three functions on Rn cross Rn, and then you compute them along the two solutions. Notice that all three are quadratic. The first and the third are obviously quadratic, but also the second is quadratic because of the condition that relates the entropy flux that I had before. Also notice that the first one is positive definite because eta is convex. Okay? And then I claim that this inequality here holds. You just compute the time derivative along the pair of the solutions for H plus the divergence of Q, and you end up with this result, which is not trivial. It's not difficult to get this inequality, but it's not trivial in the sense that you can see then the deep connection between eta and Q, right? These symmetry conditions that eta has to satisfy in order to really be an entropy. Now, if you believe, first of all, in that inequality, then it's clear how you will proceed. You will integrate this inequality over some kind of frustum of a cone. Then you will use the fact that you have that trace theorem. Right? You see, this is less equal than that, which means that this thing is necessarily a measure. Right? So since it's a measure, you can find the traces on manifolds of codimension 1, as I explained last time. So if you integrate over a frustum of a cone, you know, the usual thing, you integrate over something like that, and then you will get capital H here minus the integral of capital H on the bottom. On the side, if you choose the slope here sufficiently large, you get something that is less equal than zero, because the positive definite quadratic will dominate this thing here. And this is also quadratic. So by Gronwall's inequality, then you end up with the estimate that you want. Okay? Notice that I have used the fact that one of the two solutions is classical at least twice. First, you see, when I compute the derivative of h with respect to t and add the divergence of q, first of all, I will get, you see, I will get exactly this combination, which is less equal than zero, so this will give me a less equal sign here, this term together with that term. Then when I consider this pair, if that were also a weak solution, it would have come in with exactly the wrong side. Right. But here, because it's a classical solution, it's exactly zero, so it disappears. Right? So this is the first place where I use the fact that u bar is a classical solution. The second place is that in computing this thing here, you use the product rule of differentiation, and when you have the product of something that's smooth times something that's L infinity, the product rule works. If both were just in L infinity, the product rule does not work. Now, this is not just an artifact of the proof. In fact, if you could prove an estimate like that for two, let's say, admissible weak solutions, you would become famous overnight, especially since this is false. Okay, this is a false estimate. So this theorem is somewhat misleading. This is a theorem more or less about classical solutions, not about weak solutions. By using just simple examples, you find out that no such estimate may exist. For instance, cases that can be treated, and these are the cases where either we are dealing with a scalar equation, so n equals 1, or we are dealing with a single space dimension, that is m equals 1, the right space here is L1 and not L2. Okay? Now I will explain why, and why in these special cases we can do something, and in the general case, we can do nothing. All right, so let me consider here our system of conservation laws, and for simplicity, let me assume that it's symmetric, which means that we do have indeed a convex entropy, namely this entropy here, and let me ask the innocent question whether we can find, let's say, an LP estimate for this thing here, for p different than 2. Of course, for p equal 2, we know that once we have a convex entropy, we have an L2 estimate. Can we get an LP estimate for any p different than 2? Okay. So first, you look at the linear case, and that was already done in the 1960s by Brenner, and you find out that necessary and sufficient condition for having such an estimate for p different than 2 is that the Jacobians of this G commute. Okay? So only for such systems, you could, in the linear case, you could have such an estimate. Okay? Of course, you don't expect the nonlinear case to be simpler, and in fact, Rauch observed that if this is true for the linear, it should be true for the nonlinear case as well, at least this implication, because you can always approximate the solutions of the nonlinear problem locally by solutions of the linear problem. You start with initial data that are a very small perturbation, very smooth small perturbation, some constant, and then for a short time you do have a solution, as we saw before, a classical solution, and then if indeed such an estimate holds for this solution, then in the limit should hold for the underlying linear solution of the linearized problem, the linear problem, which exactly by Brenner's theorem cannot happen unless you have this result. And even the opposite, the reverse implication works. I proved that at least for the case n equals 2. Of course, there you need a completely different argument, but it can work. So there is something special is true for systems with that property here. Now you can see what is special about the scalar conservation law or the case m equal 1, because in both cases this condition is trivially satisfied, right? That's why in these cases we do have L1 estimates. Okay? However, if you look at systems of with both m and n bigger than 1 for which this condition is satisfied, you'll find out that there are not too many. They're not interesting systems. There are a couple, however, that have some interest. And perhaps the first step would be to treat these systems here. And sure enough, this has already started. I have here a paper by Ambrosio and Delellis that discuss such a system. I was planning to include this in my lectures, but my pace fell behind my desires here. And therefore, I have here, however, the reprint, and I'm preprint rather. I can give it to whoever, to the highest bidder somehow. Right. It's a nice paper, actually. Give you some idea of it's very geometric. You will see it's not trivial at all. To try to do something with, let's say, a system with both m and n are greater than 1 by using this. Particular system that satisfies this condition. And, okay. Now, let's see. Yeah, for p, but actually Brenner's theorem says if it works for any p different than 2, then it works for all p, between 1 and infinity included. Okay.
We're using it backwards, saying that if it works for p equals 1, then in fact it's very friendly.
Sure. Okay, so. The end result is that we know nothing about the system. There are some very important obstructions. On the other hand, if we do have a convex entropy, then certain good things happen. At least we have a local existence of classical solutions. We have uniqueness of classical solutions within the class of weak solutions, etc. But unfortunately, you see, physics even does not give us that in general. You see, what happened, talking about the convexity of the entropy, what happened to the theory? This theory came out of study of gas dynamics, essentially. The original examples came from gas dynamics. And, of course, gas dynamics were studied, had been studied for a long time by aerodynamicists and so on. And there is this famous book by Courant and Friedrichs that came out in the late 40s that collected all the results in a mathematical language. And then the theory in its form somehow, the form that I presented it, was designed by Lax in the 1950s, a famous paper, 1956, 57, I don't remember, that distilled in a certain sense what was known in gas dynamics. So all the concepts, all the assumptions that he placed within the theory came from gas dynamics somehow. And there the convexity of the entropy is certainly a fact. What is used as an entropy is a fact. Minus thermodynamic entropy, or the energy in the isothermal case, in the isentropic case, these are indeed convex functions for a gas. However, you will see that this is not the case if one considers different physical problems, right? And so I want now to consider a different physical problem and see what happens. And to do that, I will impose upon you an introduction to continuum mechanics. I hope it won't be very painful. Okay, so let me just remind you the basic structure of in continuum mechanics. You have some kind of continuum body that is characterized by its reference configuration B. So this is the reference space, it's some abstract space here that we use in order to represent our bodies. And we are interested in motions that are just maps of our of the reference configuration into the physical space we live in. Okay, so take the point x at time t to some point y. And I will be considering here Lipschitz maps. Why Lipschitz maps? Why not smoother than Lipschitz? Because I want to consider shocks. That's very important to me. And shocks are just jump discontinuities, as you will see, of the first derivatives of this function here. So they have to be discontinuous, the first derivatives. They have to be allowed to be discontinuous. Why not something which is broader than Lipschitz? I would love to do that, because there are things like dislocations and so on that are not Lipschitz, but this will not be covered by what I want to discuss here. So I will just be talking about Lipschitz motions, okay? And you have the various fields that you want to monitor, velocity, temperature, whatever you have. And this can be thought of either as functions of x and t. This is called the Lagrangian representation. You have seen that before, so this is not new to you. Or equally well, in terms of y and t, this is Eulerian representation. And unfortunately, in general, you have to use both, because sometimes one is more convenient than the other. And you have to be able to go from one to the other. So you need a notation. You know, ideally, if you have a certain field, you would need three different letters. Let's say one to identify the field, one to write it as a function of x and t in its Lagrangian coordinates, one to write it as a function of y and t in its Eulerian coordinates. You don't want to do that, so use the same symbol. And then, of course, you have to be careful when you take derivatives, because depending on what representation you have in mind, the derivatives will be different. For instance, derivative with respect to t holding x fixed, as we saw in the previous lecture here, is not the same as derivative with respect to t holding y fixed. Okay, so in continuum mechanics, you have these conventions. You have, let's say, divergence gradient with capital G to denote divergence and gradient with respect to x. And in other words, Lagrangian coordinates, and then you're using divergence and gradient with lower g in order to describe the same things in Eulerian coordinates here, and you use an overdot to have time derivatives when x is fixed, and you're using this subscript t to describe partial derivatives when you are holding y fixed. Okay, this is just a convention. After a while, it becomes second nature to you. It turns out it is convenient. So, for instance, there are two important fields that I want to define. The first one is the deformation gradient, which is the gradient of this map. So this is a 3x3, let's say we're three-dimensional mechanics, okay? Could be 1, 2, or 3. So it's three-dimensional from now on. So F will be just a 3x3 matrix-valued field. That's the deformation gradient. And the velocity, which is the derivative with respect to t of this motion here. And now, of course, in continuum mechanics, in continuum physics in general, we have conservation laws. And the typical conservation law has, again, can be written either in Eulerian or in Lagrangian form. So this is the conservation law in Lagrangian form, and this is the conservation law in Eulerian form. And this is the connection between one and the other. And let me tell you that because of the theorem that I proved last time, no, I did not prove it, I just stated, namely that you can change coordinates by Lipschitz transformation, and from one conservation law you go to the other. You remember I had divergence A equals 0 and then I changed variables and I had divergence of A star equals 0. I had P and P star, but here we have conservation laws. And A star was related to A in a particular way. You remember A star was determinant J inverse, and then I had here A, and here I have J transpose, where J was the Jacobian determinant, the Jacobian matrix of this transformation here. Here I had chi, and here I had the other thing, you remember, chi star, something like that. Taking the point x to the point x star. And what was important is that if A is just an L1 lock, divergence A equals 0 is equivalent to divergence A star equals 0. Right? This is important. So in here, the two representations are indeed equivalent, not only within the class of smooth motions, but even in the class of motions for which theta and psi and so on are in L1 lock. Okay? Now, where do these conservation laws come from? Okay? Well, some of them, of course, the most important ones come from physics. That's exactly what they express physics. But some of them come from geometry, and actually, as you will see as we go along, they are important. Well, a trivial one is this one, for instance. It expresses the integrability between f and the gradient of v. You remember, this was the spatial derivative of the motion, this was the time derivative of the motion, the second derivatives match. But let me show you two that are less sort of expected. For instance, suppose that I start with this trivial green conservation law in its Eulerian form. And let me derive its Lagrangian form. Okay? So if you use this rule here, you find out that this takes this form here. So the determinant satisfies a conservation law. Okay? This conservation law. So it's a special function in a certain sense. Let me similarly start from this, again, trivial, obvious conservation law in Eulerian, in Eulerian form, and let me go back to the Lagrangian form. You find out that the matrix F star, which is the matrix of cofactors of F, right, also satisfies a conservation law. Okay? The epsilons here are the permutation, usually the standard permutation symbols here. Okay? Again, for classical motions, these were discovered by Kim, and for instance, to prove this, it's a 10-page calculation, right? A Chinese mathematician named Kim. Right? On the other hand, if you use this thing, whose proof is just two lines, and you make that observation, the proof is just two lines. So you see, sometimes it's useful to look at weak solutions and not at classical solutions. Okay. All right, so let's keep this in mind. But as I said, conservation laws, of course, typically come from physics. And I will consider as a model here, in order to explain certain things, I will explain the theory of isentropic thermoelasticity. So in isentropic thermoelasticity, you have one conservation law, namely the balance of linear momentum that we have seen before, at least in the case of fluids. So V is the velocity, I remind you, and capital T is called the Piola-Kirchhoff stress. This is a 3x3 matrix field. And this 3x3 matrix field is determined, is computed in the following way. You have a scalar value function, epsilon of F, which is called the internal energy, is the internal energy of your body, and you take the gradient of this function, and this is the Piola-Kirchhoff stress. And as a consequence of that, you have a companion balance law, companion conservation law, namely every classical solution of this, under this assumption here, satisfies this additional equality, that this is equal to that. This is, you see here, it's the mechanical energy, it's kinetic energy plus internal energy, and this is the energy flux. So these are equal for classical solution. But in isentropic thermoelasticity, the second law of thermodynamics tells us that even if you are dealing with weak solutions of the system, this inequality must hold. This inequality exactly expresses the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, so this is the setting here. And the question is whether that entropy, so So this is an entropy and this is an entropy flux, okay? And the question is whether the entropy is convex. And of course, this part is very convex, as you can see. How about epsilon? Is epsilon convex? Is it natural to assume that epsilon as a function of f is convex? Unfortunately, physics does not allow us to assume that epsilon is convex, because, for instance, this epsilon has to be invariant under rotations. If you just take this and rotate, the internal energy does not going to change, and no such function can be convex. Now, the reason is that if you have a deformation in which f, the determinant of f goes to zero, you should expect that this epsilon grows to infinity. Or if the determinant of f goes to infinity, you should expect that this epsilon goes to infinity. You see, imagine that you have a ball made of rubber. Rubber is a good material that is modeled by such equations here. So if you take a ball of rubber and you want to squeeze it down to a point, this means the determinant of f goes to zero. Of course, you need the infinite energy to do that. Or if you want to expand it to the entire universe, again, you need infinite. And no such function can be convex. So here is an example in which this is not convex. And the lack of convexity of this function, of course, is what makes elasticity difficult and at the same time interesting. And the problem was first, of course, discussed in the context of statics, elastostatics, and many of you perhaps have seen this very beautiful theory of elastostatics. In elastostatics, you have to solve, of course, this equation, divergence t equal to zero. Right? In elastostatics, this is zero, so divergence of t equals zero. And this is just the Euler equation of this functional. So you have to minimize this functional in order to find the equilibrium, okay? And if this were convex, certainly your first temptation is to say this is convex, therefore it can be minimized. But unfortunately, it's not convex. So what is the necessary and sufficient condition on such functionals in order to have the lower semi-continuity that will give you minimization? This is the famous quasi-convexity assumption of Mori. It says that, well, if you consider a constant f, so the material is at a constant deformation gradient, and you perturb it by any other deformation that does not affect the boundary, right? It's local. Then the energy should increase. That's what this thing tells you. And this is necessary and sufficient condition for having lower semi-continuity here, okay? The trouble with this condition is that it's not localized. If I give you such a function, there is no criterion, there is no algorithm that you can tell me that this is or is not quasi-convex, okay? So people are trying to find necessary conditions or sufficient conditions to check quasi-convexity. That's correct. Exactly. So rank one convexity, which is convexity of this function just in the direction of matrices that have rank one, right, tensor product of two vectors, is a necessary condition that can be checked easily, but it's only necessary. And then there is this famous polyconvexity condition of Lax, which is sufficient, namely, this function of f is a convex function, can be written as a convex function of f, f star, and determinant of f. You remember, f star is just the matrix of cofactors and the determinant of f. So any such function is called polyconvex, and polyconvex functions indeed are quasi-convex functions, but again, this is again a sufficient condition that is not necessary, right? And these are the names of some of the people who have worked on that. So you see, polyconvexity implies quasi-convexity, this implies rank one convexity, but in general, the converse statement is not true. Okay, so this is the situation with elastostatics. Question is whether in elastodynamics, these conditions are also relevant. Do they play any role in elastodynamics? So let me formulate elastodynamics as a system of the type that we are considering here. So this is the equation of balance of momentum that I said before, and you attach to that this integrability conditions, this compatibility condition between deformation, gradient, and V. So in Lagrangian coordinates, this is the formulation of the system in Lagrangian coordinates. The state vector has, unfortunately, 12 components, namely the 9 components of F and the 3 components of V. Okay? And I remind you that T is this function here. And as I said before, for that system, we do have an entropy, which is this function here, but unfortunately, is not convex. And this is the corresponding entropy flux. And of course, the first condition, the first question is, under what conditions is the system at least hyperbolic? And you find out that the system is hyperbolic if and only if this function is rank one convex. And being rank one convex is okay. In other words, from physical point of view, this is a good assumption, whereas convexity is not. Rank one convexity is okay. Right. So the system is hyperbolic. There's no problem with assuming that the system is hyperbolic. The problem is, of course, that this thing still is not convex. It's only rank one convex. Now, what saves the day is actually that this system has a special structure. So what nature sort of takes, nature gives, another hand, which is this, that any solution of this system satisfies automatically this additional set of conservation laws, so long as these are satisfied identically at zero, right? These again are integrability conditions coming from the fact that F are first derivatives of something. This again expresses equality of the spatial second derivatives, symmetry of the derivatives. Now, this situation in which you have a system and automatically some conditions like that are satisfied by solutions when they are satisfied at time zero is quite common in physics. To give you another example that's perhaps more familiar to you is Maxwell's equations, right? This is the system of Maxwell's equations, and these are the conditions, you see, if that follow from Maxwell's equations. If at time zero the divergence vanishes, then it should vanish for all t. Okay. This is another example in which we have an entropy-entropy flux pair that is not necessarily convex. For instance, of course, in the classical Maxwell's equations in vacuo, E is a linear function of B and D, and H is a linear function of B and D, and therefore, in that case, there's no problem at all. But in nonlinear media somehow, this is an example, this Born-Infeld system that was discussed recently by Jan Brenier and Denisser, in which we don't have convexity. We still have an entropy flux pair, but the entropy is not convex again. Okay? This is not a convex function, it turns out, of B and D. Again, on the other hand, we have these additional conditions here. So let's look at this at some level of abstraction. What happens if you have such conditions, and to what extent they can help you with solving your problem. So this is sort of an abstract setting of this situation. This is your system of conservation laws, and you assume that the fluxes G satisfy this additional condition for some constant matrices, capital M. These are matrices of size, let's say, K by N. Okay? This is equivalent to saying that any solution of the original system satisfies automatically this additional condition whenever it is satisfied at time zero. Right? If this is satisfied by initial data, then the solution will satisfy this. The equation propagates somehow that condition. because of that symmetry. So this is the type of conditions we have seen before in Maxwell's equations or in elastodynamics. All right, now I fix some direction in space. I consider this matrix here. You see, this is a k by n size matrix. And notice that this matrix, the rows of that matrix lie in the null space of the adjoint of this capital lambda. Capital lambda was the matrix that defined hyperbolicity. Remember, that was the matrix whose eigenvalues were the characteristic speeds of our system in the direction u. And assume that this is non-trivial in the sense that indeed the rows of nu span the entire null space of the adjoint of capital lambda. So the rank of this is the same as the dimension of the kernel of that. Right? This is also satisfied in the example that I consider here. And then you define a cone. You take the union of the kernels of these matrices here over all nu, and the conjecture is, the expectation is, that when you're dealing with such a system, and that system is endowed with an entropy-entropy flux pair, it's not necessary that the entropy be convex. What is only sufficient is that the entropy be convex in the directions of that cone, and only that cone, right? You don't need the entire space, you only need that cone. And for elasticity, for instance, if you compute what this cone is, you find out that, all right, this is the typical state in elasticity. V has to be arbitrary, but F has to be a very special type, has to be of rank one. Right? So this would say that you don't need an entropy that is convex in all directions, you only need an entropy that is only rank one convex. Okay, let's see why. I mean, if what I said is correct, I mean, if the expectation comes out to be true. Now, it is true, but let me explain to you why it is true. Suppose that you have an involution cone. Suppose you get any matrix, any symmetric matrix, that is positive definite in the direction of the involution cone, only in the direction of the involution cone. And suppose also that this matrix, not a matrix, a matrix-valued function, has sufficiently small local oscillation. So this means that if it has a jump, the jump is sufficiently small. And it's exactly smaller than this constant here. Okay? It's just exactly that small. Then consider any W in L2 which is compactly supported in a cube and satisfies such a condition. Then the claim is that this integral is bounded by that. Now let me try to explain what this estimate means. It's a very elementary estimate. It's something that you had expected. If P were exactly convex, not convex only in the case of the evolution cone, of course, we would have had this estimate here. So the reason that we need these terms is because P is not convex. Second, assume that Q were zero, this was exactly zero, and assume that P did not depend on X. Then you end up with this kind of this kind of estimate, because you see the fact that this is zero compensates for the fact that P is convex only in the direction of the involution cone. And this is just a Fourier series or Fourier transform, just like you prove Gordon's inequality, let's say, in elasticity. You just if this is zero for some constant matrix here M, and if P is a constant matrix that is convex just in the direction of C, then again you're having this estimate here. So these two terms are here. This term is here because this is not exactly zero, but it is equal to Q. And this term is here because P is not constant, but it varies. And you understand what you do. First you assume that you take small cubes where P is almost constant, or has small oscillation because of this condition here, So it's almost constant, and then you use a partition of unity argument, like in Gordon's inequality, to get this result, and this will give you this term, which is, you see, it's of lower order than that. This is L2, this is H minus 1, and this is H minus 1, so that's what you gain here. Okay? So by using this estimate here, you can obtain, again, the local existence theorem that we had before for our system. So suppose you have a system as before. Suppose you take again smooth initial data as usual. Now you assume that the entropy is convex only in the direction of involution cone. However, you assume, so in that case, again, there exists a unique classical solution. It lies in the same space as the initial data. It blows up typically at some point where this thing becomes infinity. So it's the same theorem, exactly the same theorem we had before, except that instead of convexity of the entropy, now we assume that it is convex in the direction of the involution cone. How about the L2 stability that we had before? I think take 5 minutes and that will be through. You see, for L2 stability, again, you can prove the same result, except that now you have to make the following additional assumption. You compare now a classical solution with an admissible weak solution, which, however, is assumed to have small local oscillation. You cannot assume now that that this is an arbitrary weak solution. The oscillation, the local oscillation, has to be sufficiently small. Okay? And then you have exactly the same result. You have an L2 estimate for the distance of the two solutions in terms of the L2 distance of the initial data. So do you have to take this assumption? Here is another approach that works sometimes. Let's go back to the example of elastodynamics. So let me remind you here what I have. I have repeated things. I know the notation is complicated. You have forgotten it by now. So this is the system that I'm dealing with. The state vector, you see, is the pair of the deformation, gradient, and velocity. And this system admits this particular involution. And as I said before, the involution cone is this. So consists of F that have rank 1. And the entropy is this one. And the entropy is convex in the direction of the involution cone if and only if it has rank 1, is of rank 1 convex. And let me assume that actually I'm dealing with an epsilon here which is polyconvex. So it is a convex function, can be written as a convex function of F, F star, and determinant F. You see, this is not necessarily a convex function of F. For instance, epsilon could be exactly determinant F. And determinant F is not a convex function of F. So what can we do in that case? Well, here is something that you can do. You may reformulate the elastodynamics by just increasing its state vector. So whereas before we had just 12 components, as if 12 components were not enough, we want to make them now 22. Okay. So we attached to F and V that we had before, F star, which is the matrix of cofactors, and W, the determinant of F. Okay? And now you remember that sometime earlier in the lecture I proved that you have some conservation laws, geometric conservation laws, that are satisfied by F star and by W. So let me attach those to my system. So now my system has a different state vector, but I have attached two additional equations. These are the geometric equations I had before. It's very important that they hold only not only for classical solutions, but also for weak solutions, because now I'm dealing with weak solutions. So now you have this larger system, and this system indeed has also an entropy, but now the entropy, you write the entropy like this. So as a function of f, f star, w, and v, now this function is convex. You see, as a function of f, was not convex. But as a function of this extended set of variables, it is convex. And by using this statement, you can prove that you have, for instance, this L2 stability property between classical and weak solutions without any restriction of the size of the discontinuities for the weak solution. Okay, and Brenier and Serre tried the same thing for Maxwell's equations that Born Infeld model, and indeed they had a similar result because there too there are some additional geometric, not exactly geometric, but some additional conservation laws that are satisfied by these systems here. And there, of course, it's very beautiful because you have even more conservation laws than you have in the case of elastodynamics. Right? But in any case, you can see that at least the non-convexity of the entropy is not something that poses an impossible obstacle. On the other hand, if you want to work honestly with several space dimension weak solutions, this obstruction that we don't have any LP estimates, that we cannot have any LP estimates, is certainly for the moment completely forbidding. I mean, nobody knows what to conjecture even, let alone what to prove in that case. So this first effort, you know, small steps like this one by Ambrosio and Delellis and so on are very useful somehow. So people gain some confidence that you can do something at least in several space dimensions, but it's a long shot. But on the other hand, had you asked me 7 or 8 years ago about proving uniqueness of solution in one space dimension, I was ready to bet that would take a long time, and I'm very happy that I did not place any bets. Nobody wanted to bet with me because nobody was braver than I because I would have lost. Okay, so who knows what happens in several space dimensions. The younger people perhaps will do that before I die, but this is a difficult problem. Okay, so thank you. I'll stop here.